Well, good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to this afternoon's panel, Now Live: What's Next for Real-Time Payments in Australia? I'm Adrian Loveney from the New Payments Platform, and I'm pleased to be here moderating a panel of distinguished guests, who I'll ask to introduce themselves in a little bit more about their organization in a second. But Rachel Slade, Lindsay Bolton, Di Challenor, and Karen Webb from the ASX. What we're gonna do today is, I'm going to just show a few introductory slides just to level set, and I can see by the faces in the room, the familiar faces in the room, that some of you could equally present this material for me and possibly definitely do it better. But there are some who are less familiar with what we've done here, so we'll just do a little bit of a level set. I'll then get my panelists to introduce themselves. We'll run through some questions to start to kind of tease off discussions, to set off discussions, and then there'll be lots of time at the end for questions and discussion. So, what have we built in Australia? The key capabilities of the NPP are the real-time movement of money between accounts at financial institutions with real-time settlement of those transactions in central bank funds. And I'm gonna ask Lindsay to expand on why the RBA was particularly keen on that model in a second. The other feature of the environment is a central proxy database that you don't have to use a PayID to make a fast payment in Australia. You can make a payment to a BSB and an account number, but as most of us know, BSBs and account numbers are meaningful to my financial institution, but I still can't remember mine. So, you get the opportunity to nominate a unique number that is memorable, such as an email address or a mobile phone number or a company number, and that provides the added benefit of seeing confirmation of the pay before the payment completes. Of course, we've chosen the ISO 22022 data standard to underpin what we've built, and that gives us, over time, lots of opportunities to include structured information using the ISO data standard, which would be carried along with the payment in real time. And obviously, that makes the platform ideal for use in industry verticals, whether that's insurance or the capital markets or pensions, for example. Initially, though, the initial overlay service, OSCO, carries up to 280 characters of unstructured text, including emojis. And then finally, the other key defining feature of the platform is that it's always available 24/7, 365 days a year. As many of you will have heard us say over the last little while, we originally anticipated probably building a hub, but as you can see, we don't have a central switch in this infrastructure. What we have is a series of distributed payment gateways. Directly connected participants can have one of those gateways and connect directly to their peers. And there are eight organizations that are currently connected directly to the infrastructure, and there are about 70-75 other organizations that are connected via one of those other organizations. And we expect that number to increase over time as banks continue to build out their offerings and also using things like our API framework. The platform, of course, has a separation of infrastructure and product, so we've all collaborated around the infrastructure, and what we'll see sitting on top of the product is a series of, or sitting on top of the infrastructure, rather, is a series of products, the first of which is OSCO, and we'll also expect to see data standards developed that carry rich data for different use cases. In terms of where we are today, the New Payments Platform went live to the public in February, and each and every bank, of course, chooses to roll out the platform in a way that suits their own business objectives, and in line with their own timing. So, there are 50 million accounts that are currently reachable to send and receive payments via the NPP. In the main, organizations have chosen to launch with a retail customer base, and are now starting to roll out the service, although some did when they went live. But in the main, banks are now moving from retail customers, maybe in one channel, across a range of broader channels that might be aimed at government, institutional or corporate customers. In any given week or last week, there were just over 2.4 million transactions going through the NPP. Most of those, given the way that the platform's been rolled out, have been person-to-person payments, but we certainly expect to see movement into the business segment soon. There's no value limit imposed by the centre or indeed by OSCO in terms of transactions. So while the typical transaction is about $175 Australian, the average transaction is about $850. And the reason that the difference is obviously that there are large numbers of very large transactions going through the NPP, such as our $17 million payment, which is obviously skewing that average. Our objectives as an organisation and as an ecosystem are to do four things: to extend our reach and coverage and to continue to extend and expand on the number of accounts that are reachable, to drive volume through the infrastructure because that helps us to produce a more sustainable transaction price, to develop new capabilities, whether that's data standards or central pieces of capability that help to build use cases, developing a standard for QR codes, for example, and to support access and the development of new overlay services. And finally, where are we spending our effort and our activities as an organisation and as an ecosystem? We're doing work around standards development in high volume, high opportunity segments, particularly those where there's no clear organisation that's going to kind of step up and drive the ecosystem. We see one of our roles as helping to drive the ecosystem in high volume payment segments. Promoting standardisation and interoperability through the development of an API framework. We won't provide APIs ourselves. These people will provide APIs. But what we've developed is an API framework to help provide some standardisation and interoperability. And we've recently launched, in conjunction with Swift, an API sandbox so that fintechs and others can play with those APIs in parallel to getting access. And finally, continuing to educate the market about what's possible and how the MPP might be used over time to solve businesses and individuals' problems. So they're the kind of areas that we're focused on. With that said, I'm now going to hand over to my panellists and maybe start with Rachel Slade. If you might introduce yourself and maybe describe your connection to the NPP.
Sure, thanks, Adrian. I'm Rachel. I'm the Chief Customer Experience Officer at National Australia Bank. I'm a very proud director at MPP Australia, and I've been involved in the MPP almost since its inception in one shape or form, and was the had the executive accountability for rolling it out at NAB.
Thanks, Rachel. Lindsay.
Hi, I'm Lindsay Bolton. I'm the Assistant Governor for Business Services at the Reserve Bank. I too have been involved in MPP almost since its beginning. My area in the bank covers a broad range of payments, including the settlement of interbank obligations through the Reserve Bank Information and Transfer System, but also the provision of banking services to the government. For my sins too, I'm also responsible for note issue, which probably doesn't sit all that well with the CyBOS conference, but nonetheless.
They're
very pretty, and thank you for that was completely unprompted, by the way. My areas at the bank oversaw two parts really of the NPP development. The first one was the build and design of the fast settlement service for settling interbank obligations, but also because we provide banking services to the government, we had to build and have had to roll out a system to enable our government customers to use the new payments platform.
Thanks, Lindsay. Di.
I'm Di Challenor, and I run transaction banking at Westpac. I'm probably the newest one to the MPP family. I also am a very proud director on MPPA, and I've been involved really for the last 18 months as Westpac has rolled out and continues to roll out the platform to our customers. Our transaction services business covers payments for the whole entire group at Westpac, so retail, SME, business and institutional, and then I have the responsibility of providing cash management services to the institutional client base directly. So a wonderful opportunity. It's really exciting to be involved in MPP. I've been overseas for the last 12 years, so came back and always was in Hong Kong and heard about MPP and when are the global banks going to get connected, and now I'm as part of one of the Australian banks who's really pleased with this development and look forward to sharing our journey, which is not without its challenges, with you over the next 20 minutes.
Thanks. Karen.
Thank you. Karen Webb from the Equity Post-Trade Business Development Team at the Australian Securities Exchange. We're responsible for the clearing and settlement of equity market transactions in the Australian market. So we deal with settlement every single day and work closely with our participants and banks to make that happen. We're also very much engaged in a significant project at the moment, which is the replacement of that post-trade system known as CHESS. And we've chosen to use distributed ledger technology for that replacement and to also move from proprietary messaging to ISO 20022 messaging as well. So we've been watching MPP as we move through our own project and seeing if there are any opportunities in the real-time payment space.
Thanks, Karen. So as I flagged, I might start with Lindsay. One of the biggest architectural decisions that the industry made and one of the things that sets it apart from many of its peers is the settlement model, which has continuous 24/7, 365 settlement of each transaction line by line in central bank money via the Fast Settlement Service, for which you're accountable, among other things. Can you explain in a little bit more detail how the FSS works in practice and why this settlement approach was particularly important to the RBA?
Well, it works very much in very much the same way as a normal settlement practice, normal settlement process does. But it was built specifically for NPP. So the Faster Settlement Service was very much an NPP-inspired system of development. So it does continuous settlement, 24/7, 365 days a year, settlement of interbank obligations that arise as a result of NPP transactions, and the settlement, of course, occurs in central bank money, so a liability of the central bank. And in that sense, it's central bank exchange settlement funds in Australia are very similar to Fed funds in the US. Even though it was built, though, specifically for NPP, it was built as a component of the Reserve Bank Information and Transfer System, which generally settles general interbank obligations. So it's a component of that, and it works hand in hand with that settlement system, but very much focused on being able to provide continuous 24/7, 365 day settlement. It's a, it is novel in the sense that it's a line by line settlement, which means that you can it works in concert with the actual transfer of funds from account to account. It is, and in that sense, it enables. It enables the management of settlement and credit risk that arises through the system. It was designed specifically that way because when we were thinking about the design of this of the Fast Settlement Service, there was two objectives in mind. One was to ensure that it was worked in concert with the new payments platform, but we also wanted something that was conceptually very simple but also future-proof, something that was going to stand the test of time. As we all aware, as we all know, there are a lot of changes taking place within the payments industry around products and services. It's difficult at any point in time to stand here and think how the payment system generally is going to evolve, what kinds of products and services are going to be available in 10 years' time. But what we do know is that consumers and businesses want they want their transactions to happen in real time. They want speed. They want they want very quick verification that their transactions have taken place. So whatever services and products that are coming down the track, we needed to build a system that was actually going to be able to accommodate that. Line-by-line settlement seemed to be the way to approach that. The technology existed to provide it, and so it made sense for us to actually pursue a line-by-line settlement. We could have developed developed MPP along the lines of real-time transfer of funds between accounts, but had the settlement process, the interbank settlement process, we could have had that done on a deferred basis by providing by providing a collateral management system of some kind, but that would have just complicated the build. It would have required a collateral management system to be built. You would have had to have managed it and staffed that, of course, and that didn't seem to make a lot of sense doing that when the technology exists to actually do line-by-line settlement. So the approach was keep it conceptually very simple, but make sure that it's future-proof to handle whatever we think is coming down the track as far as payment services are concerned.
Thank you. So 6 months post go live, Rachel, maybe starting with you, and then I'll ask the other panelists. What are your reflections on the journey that your organisations have taken to get here, and what have you learnt, and what perhaps might you have done differently?
Excellent set of questions. I think the thing I wouldn't do differently was getting really clear on scope and channel up front and sticking with that. And we chose, because our heartland of our bank is a business bank, we were very committed to having the service available to our business customers from day one. So we launched to our business and retail customers day one, and that was, I think, the right decision, and customer feedback's been great. In terms of what we would do differently, I think one thing we might, and it's a small thing, but we didn't fully appreciate how customers were going to use the data. And so I think we would have done some more testing with our customers, because what we found early was, because there was also a little bit of inconsistency in how all of the participants present that usability to their customers, there was, like, some of the customers were a little bit confused, and also used it in ways we hadn't anticipated. So we've responded to that, but I think it's just one of those lessons in potentially doing some more customer and usability work. We were all very focused on a very big, complex technical implementation, so probably just a slight upweighting in the customer testing piece.
Thanks. Mm. Die, perhaps?
I think from my perspective, at Westpac we try to do everything sort of perfect day one. You know, we've got this goal that we're going to launch MPP across all of our segments, and we're going to address the compliance issues, we're going to look at sanctions, we're going to have fraud, we're going to have all the bells and whistles. And I think sometimes it's probably more important, as I reflect and coming into the program a little bit later, was what's really the minimal viable product that we need to go to market with? And I think as I reflect on all large technology projects, you often get so focused on this big project that you're delivering. If you think about MPP, and if you reflect on the Australian banking system, this is probably the most significant change in the banking system since direct entry. Even when we had terminals rolled out years ago, like FPOS and bring that to market. So the significance of that change probably sort of put us all in the mind frame as, let's do this massive big technology project, rather than coming back into and saying, well, what do clients really need day one? And what is the and how do we build on that? And as I reflect, and I'm working on a number of significant projects at Westpac at the moment, I'm taking the learning and saying, let's just deliver modular components to customers. Let's not try and boil the ocean and deliver too much. And I think that we need to think more like our fintech providers, who go, what product can I get out to suit clients, not overboil the ocean, and know you'll get there over time, and focus on probably those smaller things rather than those big, you know, hairy problems that I face on a daily basis.
Thanks. Lindsay, maybe from your perspective, what have you learnt? What might have you done differently?
Well, I tend to divide the lessons. There's always lessons. I tend to divide the lessons up into the implementation lessons and the run lessons. And I think it's fair to say that on the run lessons, we probably haven't had a lot of experience there to know what they are, but we do know that the system is meant to be open and accessible, and so I think anything we've got to be careful of there is making sure that we live up to the mantra there, that it is open and accessible. But on the implementation, there's a number of different things, and I think and you can look at it at a couple of different levels. I think one of the most important things is that one of the most important lessons is that critical mass is important to launch this, but it's also very difficult to figure out what that is. Mm. Obviously, you don't want to start with just one participant ready to go. That doesn't make any sense at all. At the same time, you can't move at the pace of the slowest mover, because I think the public and the regulators will get impatient with that, which means there's a huge middle ground. Somewhere in that middle ground is a sweet spot, but it's not at all obvious where what that sweet spot actually is. Did we get it right? I think, generally speaking, probably yes. We've started out I think when we started, we had something in the order of 60 participants ready to go, which was great. There was a diverse range of participants, so it was not only banks, there was also aggregators involved in that, which I think is fantastic because it gave the broad brush of services available to consumers. But I also think that and only the test of time will tell this, I think, is, you know, would it have been better if we had started with a bit more focus on the business customers, for example? Quite possibly it would have driven volume a bit more, but you don't know that up front. And so you really have to take a little bit of guess as to what is the right critical mass, what is the right amount of business and participants you need in the system in actual fact to go live. I think another very important thing, which is a little bit more fundamental to the actual implementation, is that it's very important in putting a system like this in place, in bringing everybody together to put something in place which by and large is a utility for the payment system, is that you need a very strong project management office to help, a strong and independent project management office to help push everybody through, because everybody has different agendas. We all have the same objective, but we all have different agendas in how we're actually going to achieve that. And a good project management office will bring all that together, make sure the documentation is right, push towards particular timeframes to make sure that they're there, that people arrive at them at the right time. And I think that's very, very important. There's a couple of other things. You know, it's very important to make sure that you have, that in our case, I think that we had an addressing service ready to go right from the start. That makes the utility of the system very, very convenient for people to use, attracts them into it. And I also think that making sure you had the right message format for the system, and I think the ISO 222 is exactly the right one. It's the right one to meet the requirement for the future-proofing of the system, I think. So I think that they are some very important lessons for us.
Absolutely. Karen, you've already publicised, I think it was one of the first decisions you made in your program was to move to the ISO standard in common with many other large sophisticated stock exchanges around the world. And as well, of course, you're moving to your own technology stack and a replacement for CHESS. What kind of benefits and features and opportunities do you see the new payments platform as, you know, in terms of data-rich payments offering the ASX?
We've been exploring a number of opportunities with our customers. So through the project, we've had quite an extensive stakeholder engagement process over the last couple of years. And CHESS is very efficient today. It does a great job. But so the conversation was more around, are there any problems out there or things we want to do better to create further efficiencies in the market? So if I just take a couple of examples from settlement in particular. So we have a single netted DVP batch per day, and that works very efficiently we use payments through RITs to satisfy that, and each bank that's a participant in that process has a net pay or net receive obligation. We're not proposing to change that batch process, but we can see some other opportunities around DVP settlement or other transactions that we support that could use the real-time payment process. So one example is we currently support DVP settlement outside the batch, but the cash component of that transaction is actually managed separately to CHESS. We don't have any linkage, so that means for our participants it creates possibly a clearing and counterparty risk in making sure that settlement is effective. So the opportunity is for us to seek a solution where we do actually provide that payment solution as well, and it can be real time. And then the examples of where that could be used is if a participant's missed the single batch, they haven't received instructions in time, that sort of thing, and can catch up later in the day and transact that on a bilateral basis. It could be used for securities lending or other larger transactions that have a more immediate issue that they need to sell them quickly. So there's a few opportunities there. So We're looking at those. And we also operate a service where we provide, in the batch process, the redemption and application process for non-listed funds, known as MFund. And same thing, it's going through the batch at the moment, but whether we can explore opportunities to provide a real-time payment support for that and take it out of the batch and make it more effective for the holders that are involved in that and their participants. We're also looking at a few other things for MFund where it may be able to help distribute funds as well, or payments distributions from the fund holding.
Thanks for that.
Yeah.
Rachel, Di, Lindsay, the three of you provide institutional corporate services to you know, governments and businesses and institutions. What level of interest are you seeing from your respective client bases? And you know, can you tell us perhaps what is the most frequently mentioned use case or benefit? And if you're prepared to, maybe what's the most novel or unique that you've heard so far? If I could start with you, Rachel.
It was interesting. When we first started out on this journey, I kept saying, oh, like the fast part's not really that interesting. But the fast part is becoming a bit more interesting to some clients. And I think it's the speed, but also the availability. So and in general terms, I just call it extended hours, the fact that you can, you know, make a payment over the weekend after 4:30. And probably the most interesting thing we're working on right now, so we've just been doing a pilot with Swift, actually putting GPI together with real-time payments. And so we've proved that we can get a payment from, you know, Singapore or China, from that Chinese bank into a beneficiary account here in 18 seconds in a test environment, so hopefully faster in production. But the speed's interesting, but actually the pain point it solves for most customers is the cut-off time issue. So, you know, we've all had clients complain about currency cutoff times, and particularly in Asia and the Pacific, it's a real problem. So that's probably an interesting one. It's like not that novel, but sort of where the future, I think, is going. And there's lots of conversations about how we connect, you know, cross-border payments to some of the domestic systems. So that one's quite interesting. One we're talking to a client about at the moment is a client that works in the kind of gig shared economy, who at the moment, you know, pays their participants once a day, and they're looking at potentially paying at the end of a shift instead of at the end of the day, or even kind of more frequently throughout the day, because all of that's possible. And I think what we'll see there is a real increase in volume of payments, I think, because of that sort of convenience of being able to make multiple payments without having to wait for any reconciliation processes to happen in the background. So, and then there are the ones we've been talking about, I know all of our customers have been talking about for a while, like disaster payments are a great use case for NPP. So instead of, you know, someone having to schlep out to somewhere with a bag full of prepaid cards, you know, real-time credit can be put into needy customers' accounts in the moment. So that's one we all feel good about as well. So
great.
Yeah.
Lindsay, in terms of your work with government?
Look, the government has been very interested in using MPP right from the start. And as the service provider, as the banking service provider to the government, and interestingly, as a central bank, we actually are unusual in the sense that we actually have to compete for the government's business with commercial banks. So we have an interest in our customers being interested in NPP, but they are particularly interested for a number of reasons. Di mentioned one, emergency payments. In fact, that's probably will be the first cab off the rank as far as the government is concerned. And emergency payments, so not just for natural disasters, but each day the government makes about 2,000 emergency payments across the country, and it's to payments to people in distressed circumstances. So they might be, for example, victims of domestic violence who are out of their homes and have no access to funds, and so the government can actually get payments to them almost instantly when these people are actually standing at the counter or on the phone talking to them. So a significant benefit from that point of view. And in fact, the Reserve Bank is already underway with a program to migrate those payments from the existing RTGS system across to MPP. The government also has a particular interest, though, in in some of the services which aren't yet available through MPP, but which are coming. So that's a request to pay. And the ATO is particularly interested in request to pay.
I bet they are,
yes. So even though you might say, well, that just means I have to pay my tax more quickly than I have in the past, but the fact of the matter is that that's their business. So they're interested in that. But combining that with payment with a document. So whenever there's a tax payment, there's documentation that goes with it, there's tax assessments, there's information that has to flow back to the taxation office. That's true also of welfare payments. So the Department of Human Services, which administers many of those welfare payments, often has to send documentation with the payment. So that might be a change of payment assessment, change of address, some kind of change of circumstance. Information also has to flow back to the government. So they're very interested from the point of view in those two services. And I think those two services are also the ones which businesses generally, not just the government, but businesses generally would get significant advantage from. So I think it's important as an industry that we make sure that we provide those services through to our customers and keep that as an important part of the program going forward over the next 12 months or so. But certainly the government is very interested in those particular services, very interested in MPP. The only qualification I would have is that the government typically doesn't have a lot of resources available to it, so it tends not to want to move to take part of schemes like a new payments platform until it can see the whites of its eyes, until it knows that it's there, almost ready to go and being used, and then they're keen to actually make sure they do the integration work in their own system to be able to use it. So they're very conscious of not wasting time or people's money, mainly because of their resource constraint. But I think we're at that point now where the system is live, it's got enough credibility, the government is actually already moving to take advantage of those services. But the services that it would really like to see are the things like, as I mentioned, request to pay and payment with a document.
Thanks. Di?
Well, I mean, we've got two product pillars that we're working on at Westpac. One is around helping our corporate treasurers unlock the liquidity within their enterprise. And it's called the Digital Institutional Bank. So we're working on a multi-year development around really bringing best practices of liquidity management into Australia and New Zealand. And if you think about liquidity and faster payments and bringing those together for a treasurer is really, really critical. And if we could look at how we bring just-in-time funding into that, and we've been thinking through, and MPP is the best way to deliver that. For us, we see this as a real way to help corporates unlock liquidity throughout their enterprise and use MPP as the way to be able to deliver that and also to receive money more quickly, send money more quickly, and really harness their working capital solutions. So working through that is a key priority for us. The other pillar that we're working on is around digitising procurement. And if you see from a Westpac perspective, we have been the leader in Quick Super and the rollout of the government's initiatives around superannuation payments. We have over 55% of the market in that area. So right now that's delivered through direct entry. So whilst it's very efficient, the speed that we can deliver to our clients in that industry can really then enable them to make better decisions for their customers really quickly in terms of moving their money, getting it into the funds quickly and benefiting from that real-time experience. And if you then think through other initiatives that Adrian put up in his initial slides, like single-touch payroll. So again, payroll today is a batch process. We see that evolving into the MPP space. We learn from the UK faster payments challenges that they had when they rolled that out, but the single-touch payroll, again, being able to deliver information through the MPP rails and the payment. And I think that's the real beauty that we see in the MPP platform. It's, yes, you know, just about the payment, but it's around the information that we can carry with that. So that is a really big focus for us. Both the state and federal governments recently have come out around e-invoicing and their desire to move to that. We've already tested e-invoicing with the New South Wales state government, and we see e-invoicing and MPP coming together. So those set of standards, moving those into the MP standards, the ISO standards, and then delivering the payment at the same time, we can really see commerce moving much quickly and much faster across the country. So for us, liquidity and helping our corporate treasurers unlock that and using MPP to provide that just-in-time funding through to digitising procurement and working with the government around a number of initiatives that are going on, not only to, you know, improve the visibility and transparency of information, but help people do more business. So I think MPP, just the movement of money instantaneously, helps people do more business. And that's what we need. We need growth in our economy. We need payments to be simple. We need the Uber experience in our day-to-day lives. So that's where we're really focused on, apart from rolling out. You know, that's our big focus, is getting it live across all of our segments.
Thanks, Di. And maybe to finish with you, Karen, in terms of the broader securities industry and ecosystem, what opportunities and use cases do you think the NPP will help to enable, and what capabilities, you know, like APIs, for example, do you think it's important for the system to develop to help those opportunities to flourish?
We've been thinking about the ecosystem in which we operate as a securities market infrastructure, and as a capital market, really, at the end of the day, we're bringing together issuers and investors, and we have a whole lot of intermediaries in between, including ourselves. So there's a particular use case that we've been working on, and that's around corporate actions. You know, that's one of the key things that issuers and investors get involved in, whether it's a dividend distribution or the issuer trying to raise capital and seeking that from the investors or new investors. So we've done a lot of work as a listing exchange on trying to improve the announcement process around corporate action events, and we've adopted ISO 20022 for a notification service. So now that we're using 20022 in the post-trade platform replacement, that helps us to develop a more streamlined process for the management of the corporate actions, which we haven't really gotten involved in before. So we're looking to introduce in the day one implementation of CHESS a facility to help streamline the process for investors working through their participants to accept entitlement offers, for instance, and also to make the associated payment. And a real-time payment platform could benefit that in making it more instantaneous, also for us to one day maybe shorten the timelines associated with corporate actions. Once an issuer now announces a dividend, it actually takes quite some time for that dividend to be paid. And likewise, to take up an entitlement, you know, it takes quite some time to work through the process. There's a myriad of ways that an issuer can take that up now, through checks or electronic fund transfer or whatever it is. So we'd like to offer an optional process to streamline that and really make some efficiencies there. The other benefits could be that, you know, when you accept an entitlement offer, there may be scale back, so the money might need to flow back the other way from the issuer back to the holders, so we could facilitate that as well. So a lot of opportunity, we think, in the corporate actions space in particular. So the other point is, I think we've got a similar approach to MPP where we're trying to develop a platform, the distributed ledger technology supported platform, where we're not planning to do everything out there in the market to, you know, improve services, make new services and so on. But we think through the different connectivity options that we're proposing through that platform, whether it's a DLT node or messaging, APIs and so on, that others could help to enhance those processes as well and provide that interconnectivity with MPP or other platforms.
Great. Thanks, Karen. Mm. So I want you to get your questions ready. We're gonna open up to the floor in a couple of minutes with an opportunity for you to ask questions. But before we do that, maybe one last question to the bankers towards this end of the panel. We're seeing in other countries moves to rationalise and streamline multiple domestic clearing streams, either by moving to an interoperable common credit message in the case of the UK, or by taking more active steps towards rationalisation and simplification. Do you think this is a desirable step in Australia? And if so, how should we approach it? Rachel?
I think it's not only desirable, I think it's almost inevitable. Because one of the challenges when you roll out something new and expensive, we spent $1 billion on the MPP, so let's assume it was that. But is you then deal with this issue of, you know, how do you deal with kind of legacy and you know, redundancy? And so you don't want a future where you're just sort of laying on cost and cost to maintain and cost to renovate, right, as customer needs change and technologies change. So I think to Lindsay's point, the fact that NPP has been built in, I think, a reasonably future-proof way, both the architecture, the messaging choice and the settlement service, and the addressing service, frankly, which I think is a really important component that we haven't talked much about today, presents lots of opportunities. Certainly, I mean, RTGS, you'd imagine, is probably like the most obvious sort of next candidate. We're already seeing very large payments, and it's solving a similar customer need. Direct entry is the next sort of logical sort of
haven't
candidate.
Talked about checks, right?
Well, I was coming. I'm sure Lindsay wants to talk about checks. I'm very passionate about the future of checks.
Which way?
Well, I think one way only. Okay. I was horrified at a Cybos event the other night when, you know, someone handed over a giant check as a like charity payment to it. I was like, oh, come on. Like, we're at a payments conference in the 21st century and we're like, we've got giant novelty checks. We should be setting fire to them. So I think, and how we should do that, and I think, you know, AusPayNet is starting to do some really interesting work. They're our payments self-governance organisation that looks after our clearing streams, and the Australian Payments Council is also doing some work about, you know, the future of, I think, what do we call it? Managing the payments mix, which was kind of a great euphemism for what are we going to do about checks. But I think the next logical kind of things on that agenda are the other clearing streams. So I'm excited about that future. I think there's good action underway, and I'm sure Lindsay's going to talk about checks.
Well, I thank you, Rachel. I think the short answer to your question, Adrian, is yes. There has to be some rationalisation. It doesn't make, you know, commercial sense or even sense from a consumer's point of view to be operating half a dozen different clearing streams when in actual fact there's one of them that will do most of what the others will do and probably in a better way. So when you think about it like that, there's two kinds of things will happen. One is that we'll probably see some of the existing clearing streams absorbed into one of the others, and my guess is that NPP will absorb in time those others. We'll end up seeing possibly different ways in which you can clear and settle a payment, but it might only go through one piece of technology. And what will be the difference as to whether or not you do an MPP real-time payment or something similar to a DE will be the content of the message, right? And so, and that makes it very easy if in going down the track, if you want to, for future-proofing your system, because if some other system comes along, then you could accommodate it within a system like MPP. You could accommodate those kind of payments within a system like MPP simply by changing the message rather than by having to build a significant piece of infrastructure.
This is
the UK model. So I think that's ultimately, in that sense, where we're going to go. Having said that, there are some obvious candidates for payments streams and clearing disappearing, and checks is probably the most obvious one. At the moment, there's less than a quarter of a percent of payments that get made in the country are done using checks, and that number is shrinking, you know, year by year, day by day, almost. And the Australian Payments Council, as Rachel mentioned, has been doing some work in this. They've been looking at why people still use checks, who still uses them and why they use them, and what are the impediments to changing to something a little bit more convenient, a little bit more contemporary. So they've done a lot of work in this, and there's still some pockets of the community that still use checks. And so the intention is that that the members of the Payments Council will come together to put a plan in place that will assist those communities, those sectors of the community that still use checks, to make them aware of the alternatives that are available now, and to assist them in migrating over to those new systems. So we'll eventually get to the point, if that's successful, where we could actually set a date for closing down the check system. We're not at that point yet, but I think if the plan that the Australian Payments Council has works and works well, we're probably not too far away.
Thanks. Di, last word?
I think my colleagues have, you know, really addressed that very well. I've been thinking about this a lot. I moved back to Australia almost 2 years ago now, and I remember getting all my utility bills and looking them at all and seeing all of the different ways I could make payment, and coming from Hong Kong, and there was really only two choices, either a bank transfer or you go to 7-Eleven and pay your bill. And the question really is to the room: is there a fear in terms of limiting the number of payment options that you have that you can collect money from people? So is Australia ready to sort of say, well, there's only one way to pay, and that's a BPAY MPP solution? Sorry, I did that for you, John. But you know, is there one way to pay? And then at an industry consolidation level, of course, we're going to need to consolidate payment systems. It's not the right thing for us to be running multiple and almost competing payment systems. But I think the question is to my corporate and institutional clients and to us as consumers, will we all converge to one payment method? So I think it's on to not just the banks to drive this, but for consumers and businesses and corporates to come on the journey with us in terms of driving how they want to make payments.
Great. I think you've, you know, issued a challenge to the audience.
Yep, that's I like it.
So we've got, you know, a little bit of time left for questions. Have we got a taker? In the front, Michael. Just a microphone coming behind you.
I've got two if I can.
We'll see.
One for the central bank. I think I heard some words open and accessible, which I certainly endorse. But in terms of consolidation of payment systems, direct entry in particular, which has a huge volume going through it, and then others, checks and so on. At what point in time does the Reserve Bank deem NPP as systemically important and therefore consider a designation process?
Well, you're not getting a second question now, Michael.
Well, I mean that to some extent that's a question of how long is a piece of string. And to a large extent, I think Rachel has answered the question. Di has answered the question.
We do know each other. Yeah. Well.
My colleagues
this
have answered the question. To some extent,
and the board.
To some extent, they've answered the question. Is that it really depends on the consumer demand for a particular service? I think we would see the payment system as a whole as being systemically important. So you're not just singling out one particular component, that the whole lot of it is systemically important. I think it would be fair to say that as changes happen, there might be one part of it that's not necessarily seen as being critical going forward, and the check system is probably close to that at the moment. But I think overall, if you're looking at the choices that are available to consumers in order to make payments, you'd have to look at almost everything else as being as being systemically important, and therefore it's important that all of those systems operate as efficiently as possible. Whether one ultimately dominates or not is really up to the industry to decide. It's not up to the central bank to do it, and I think consumers and businesses together will make that decision.
Go on then.
Second one was in terms of open and accessible. I'll come back to that initial comment. A bank-owned initiative. How does I guess NPP and the participants demystify that this is bank-owned and there is no incentive to introduce new entrants?
You want
well,
to
I could answer that, or I'm going to hand over to you, Rachel.
Well,
moderating.
I think actually there's plenty of incentive because the commercial model for MPP is very simple. So, and it needs to be a commercially sustainable entity, and for it to be commercially sustainable, it needs volume. The owners don't want to perpetually, subsidise. It's not how it's designed. So, in fact, the more volume that runs through the MPP, the better for all of the participants, for the sustainability of the entity, and frankly, for funding, you know, future development and innovation, which is what it was born out of, was this challenge around providing a way to, for there to be more innovation in the system in general. And Adrian, I'm sure, can talk to some of the conversations that MPP has with potential other participants and how the, how they think about using it and what they want to use it for.
Mm.
Or you can say whatever you like, because
sure.
you don't work
I mean,
for me.
Look, the NPP was designed as open access, and I've just come from another session with a bunch of central bankers who are looking at what we've built, you know, kind of amazed at how this industry-led initiative was designed this way. But open access doesn't mean open slather. You know, you need to have a range of different access points that are appropriate for different organisations of different regulated status. You know, my sense is, and the organisation's sense is, and it was also, sorry, the other thing I'd say is it involved a diverse range of organisations in putting this together, from, you know, organisations like ASL and INDU and Cuscal and the Big Four banks and others. So it really was designed by a bunch of organisations, literally fueled by coffee over a number of years, to kind of design a system that would solve some of the common pain points, like portability of account numbers with PayID. So we've designed those things in from the get-go. But I think, you know, it's up to us to make it work. It's up to us to see what we've built translated into practice and to explain how it works and to build familiarity. And as we know, some banks are still rolling out the services to their customers. So for us, you know, doing things like an API framework and a sandbox was really important to help provoke the ecosystem and to ensure that when banks start developing their APIs, which they're doing now, to make sure that they that they're broadly developed in a way so that they're consistent and interoperable and people can move between them. So I think the acid's on us as an ecosystem to demonstrate that what we've built is open, and I absolutely know that that if it's not, then you know we all know what will happen. So, you know,
Can I just add something there too? I think, you know, that's one of the lessons we're going to learn, because we've only really just started out down this road as to how we handle that open access. But I think if you look at it so far, you'd have to say it's living up to its purpose. We started out, as I mentioned earlier, with 60 organisations involved. There was a broad range, so it wasn't just the major banks. In fact, we started without a couple of the major banks being perfectly ready at that stage. So I think if you look at it from that point of view, it's already sort of ticked the first box, leapt the first hurdle. But you know, we've only really just started on this journey, and so far the signs are good.
Thanks. We've got one up the back. Yep, I've got
you. Thank you. What have the economic impacts of NPP been to the banks represented on the panel?
Is that asking that how much does it cost?
Are you asking how much it costs, whether there's revenue churn as a result of it, all of those
exactly.
things?
Exactly. So we know the expense side of the equation. There's technology costs and 24/7. So we know that goes up. How about the income side of it and some of the halo effects around the income side of it, attracting more customers, et cetera?
Yeah. And I think where you went with the question is the way that you need to think about it, particularly on the consumer side. So there's no market... I don't think we've seen any market in the world that can charge customers to make a real-time payment, because customers' expectations just in their lives say that, you know, they should. That's an experience that they would expect, and we should provide that for them. So I think you really have to, and I think frankly it's too early to have real numbers to talk to. The customer experience is definitely improved, and we've had great feedback on that. For customers who are interested in the things it provides, some customers don't even think about it. So, but as they start to use it, they start to imagine, particularly small businesses, different ways that it can add value to their businesses. I think the other area where there are real collateral benefits from what we've done from a you know, more kind of enterprise perspective are the necessary things you need to do when you're effectively transitioning your payments business from a batch world into a real-time world. So particularly things around real-time fraud management. So they deliver benefits in other parts of the business and through other channels in a future where so many more payments, so payment volumes are going to go up, but also just the proportion of payments that are being done digitally is going up. So having uplifted that capability in and of itself delivers a lot of benefits. So too early to say, you know, is it a positive NPV business case? Couldn't say.
Other perspectives?
Oh, I think Rachel said it really well, right? I mean, I think the economics of this will be proven over time. As we start to collaborate with fintechs and come up with overlay services, I think that's where we hope that that economic value for ourselves and for the industry starts to unfold. I think the data will be the very interesting component of that. What data does that give us? And along the lines of what Rachel was saying is, how do we look at fraud differently? How do we get more insights in terms of what's happening across the ecosystem? And are there ecosystem solutions that could come off the back of this? So, you know, the profitability of this will unfold over time.
I think I think Diane, Rachel have sort of said it very succinctly, that the horizon here is that you have to take here is long. Mm. If you sat when we started looking at this, if you sat down and did a business case, you would not come up with a business case that said, yep, go ahead with it, right? If you took a purely analytical approach over a horizon, which you would normally take, you would probably not be able to mount a good business case here. But there's an element here which I think is very important, that is, this is nation building to some extent. You know, we're actually putting in place the rails that's going to provide a service to consumers and to both households and businesses going forward for a couple of decades at least. And when you look at it from that point of view, it makes sense to actually do it. The thing which I find actually really fantastic about the way in which the MPP has been developed is that there is essentially a utility component, and then the overlay services provide the commercial opportunity here. And I think when you put those two things together, it's been very successful in bringing the industry in the industry collaborating to provide the service, because they've been responsible for building the utility, but there's also a commercial overlay which over a period of time will provide them with commercial opportunity. May not necessarily exist now, but if you look at it from the point of view of nation building, then it does make sense.
Okay. Bernard.
Bernard Kellerman, Banking Day. Someone, as we know, has tried really hard to help you out with your liquidity, that $17 million single transaction. I'm hoping that, I'm intrigued by it. Are you able to, or could we get, without giving away obviously client details, is there any indication as to what it was? It wasn't people having a lunch and settling the bill.
Would have been a great lunch.
I presume it wasn't. Is it a house purchase, something like that? Is it a sign of things to come?
Lindsay, do you maybe want to answer that question, Lindsay?
I don't know. I don't know the details of the transaction, but I think you know. Yes, it is a sign of things to come. We did speak earlier about what does the future look like here, and would we necessarily see something like the UK has planned, where you see payment systems collapse down into one and there'd be a difference in the way in which you settle things, simply reflected in the message. I think MPP was built value and volume agnostic to a large extent. So 17, you know, you can put a $17 million dollar payment through it. You can put a $100 million payment through it if you so desire. But what it suggests to me is what you've indicated, that's the future, right? And that may be a one-off, but I suspect as we go forward, you know, in 5 to 10 years' time, you'll be seeing more and more of those kind of transactions put through the system.
I think I'll just add to that, Bernard, by saying I think to Lindsay's point, there's no limit in the system itself. The challenges in being able to enable more large payments like that, which really solve customer pain points, particularly in the check space. Right, you often, you know, the old bank check is often the solution to a high value payment. Mm-hmm. Is that for most of the participants, certainly for us, we're setting limits in our channels rather than for the system, which is about how comfortable we are that we know the customer, we know they are who they say they are. Because in a real time world, once you make a real time irrevocable payment, it's very hard to get it back. So So there's work I know in individual institutions going on about things like temporary limits with extra authentication to be able to enable some more of these use cases. So house deposit's a good example, house settlement. Given that we're in, you know, an e-conveyancing world now as well, how do you bring that settlement piece and the documentation piece together? They're great examples of where I think this can take the customer experience.
Yeah, that's what I was asking. Sorry, just a slight follow-up. So you're unable to give the category of what it is? Of
payment? I don't think we would.
We'd be allowed to anyway.
I had
heard that it might have been a payment involving a government department.
So if you want people to use the system, if you tell them, look, someone's paid their tax bill with this, how much they paid, it'll encourage people. That's what I
think. I mean, I think it's a real testament to what we've built. Mm. Not that we want to engage in unhealthy comparisons to what used to be the mother country, but I think, you know, the UK faster payment system is 10 years old. My understanding, I might be proven wrong, is that they've just clicked over to £1 million. I think they started with £100,000. So to have a system with a settlement model that's capable of processing, 17 million payments within the kind of first couple of months is, I think, an impressive reflection of what we've built and its robustness. So on that point, I might ask you to join with me in thanking our panellists. And we finish right on the dot. So thank you. Thanks for your time.
Well moderated.